This is Mark from Northeast Photographic, and you are listening to Scary Stories to Tell in the Darkroom. This is a Brennan-free episode today. I'm actually going to get into an interview that I did. I'm pretty excited about this interview. It's for a scanning service that's not my own. It's a guy named Michael Strickland. He's a great follow on Instagram. He is a landscape photographer that's based out west, and he also has his own drum scanning service. He scans film with a scanner called a Heidelberg Tango. Drum scanners are these, he'll explain it better than I can. They are basically the best possible way to scan film that has ever been made. And, you know, you're talking about files in the hundreds of megabytes, hundreds of megapixels, and thousands of megabytes, so you're definitely, all of these files come in the gigabyte size, and if you're looking to do the largest possible print and the finest possible reproduction, you get a drum scan, and they're not cheap, but the quality is totally worth it. So I was really excited to talk to him about his services and about his landscape photography and how he kind of found film, because like a lot of the people that are shooting film now, he didn't start with film. He started with digital. We touched on how, like, I'm from probably the last generation that started on film, and then so many people now are just, you know, they start digitally and then they move to film. We talk about work and scanning work and why we love film and why we love slide film. It's a good interview. I'm excited to get it out there, and I'm excited to talk to more people in photography, let them kind of tell their story and talk about what they do and how they work, especially people that are not talked to as much as you hear in a lot of the other photography podcasts. Probably it's not gonna be a lot of wedding photographers in this podcast. I shoot weddings, and I love to shoot weddings, but I don't think that they're necessarily the most interesting stories to tell in what is, I think, at its best, a storytelling medium. I should talk about some of the stuff that I've sort of been sharing on Instagram this week with the lab. You can see that I'm working on a new sort of an e-commerce platform. You might know now that I have my online order entry system. It's pretty bare bones right now. It works pretty well, although there's some significant holes in sort of the way it works. It's not very smart. I can't customize it very much, so totally revamping that. And then some people have inquired. I used to, when I started, you may know or remember that I had a great loyalty program, I guess the better way to say it is customer rewards program. But anyway, the whole concept of it was to basically reward you for shooting more film and hopefully enable you to shoot more film, and also just say thanks for using the lab. One of the impetuses of this, is that the right word, impetus? I don't know. Anyway, one of the impetuses of this was I know that a lot of the big labs in the industry, they give special rates to certain photographers, and those photographers kind of act as brand ambassadors, or you know, they hashtag their images, you know, whatever photo lab, and I don't want to name names, but they kind of are very vocal about which lab they use, and that in turn, you know, you say like, oh my gosh, my favorite industry photographer is using this lab, so this is the lab that I should use. But the problem that I see with that is that these people are already successful to a great degree, so I think it rewards success with better rates. And I mean, not to say that, like, if you are a very successful photographer and you shoot all film and you send all your film to that lab, like, they should give you a better rate. But they should do it because you're sending them a lot of film, not necessarily rewarding you just for being a big photographer. So I wanted to offer that system basically to everyone. If you send me film and you are shooting a lot of film, then yeah, you deserve better rates. I mean, like, I should be saying thank you to you, because guess what? You're not just supporting the lab and hashtagging on Instagram. You are putting dog food in Moses's bowl. You are paying my mortgage. You are allowing me to live sort of this life out here in Maine that I've kind of constructed for myself. It's a modest one. I'm not buying any fancy cars. I'm just trying to keep my old Subaru on the road. But, you know, I really do want to say thanks for stuff like that. And I want to I've said this before, but I never want anyone to say shooting film is too expensive. If you're a photographer and you're serious about photography, you know, it is an expensive hobby. Like, it's not cheap. Cameras are, they don't give them away. Good cameras, especially, you know, digital is not cheap. You know, if you're serious about photography, even the Micro Four Thirds cameras they're coming out with now are in the $3,000 range. Excuse me. Film cameras are cheaper, but they're getting more expensive. But film is getting more expensive to some extent. But, like, you know what? I offer a way to get scans for $10. That doesn't include the cost of the roll. You had that, but I want to keep that level of affordability for people. And if you shoot a lot, you know, I haven't worked out the details in the new rewards program, but you're going to start to see probably percentages off. I don't know. I'm trying to work within the limitations of it's sort of like an app on my end of a way to construct these things. The reason why I went away from the rewards program that I used to have was because it was all just done by a spreadsheet, and I kind of kept track of people's roles, and I would say, okay, you're at this price level now, and I would just have to sort of remember. I don't have a ton of clients, but like I have too many now that I can do it all by spreadsheet, so it needed to be automated. So hopefully now it's just going to all be automatic over the website. I'm probably going to move completely to online ordering. You know, this is not to say that you can't just like send in film with like a piece of paper saying like develop it this way, do it this way, and I'll just send you an invoice. That's probably fine. But the services that I have now, without like paying a graphic designer to sort of make all new order forms for me to encompass the new services that I've launched, which I don't really want to do, the old order forms just don't have all those features and things like that. So yeah, I think I'm going to move to the all online ordering. I think it's easy. I think it's a good system. You know, you basically just tell me what you're going to send in, you pay, and then once I receive your film, I print out your invoice and I attach all your information to that. So I don't know. I hope that it makes this easy for you. And like I said, you'll be able to start earning rewards. So anyway, I'm really excited about that. That's going to be launching within the next few weeks. I'm going to have some friends test it, to make sure it's all working and pretty bug-free at launch. But, you know, it's not my number one skill. So I spend a lot of time cursing at my iMac while I'm doing it. And then I slowly, through the process of figuring out how this system works, like get it all set up. But I don't know, it's exciting. So I'm happy to always to streamline stuff and launch new things like the loyalty program. So anyway, I don't want to take up any more airspace. I think that you're definitely gonna want to Google Michael Strickland after this interview to put some of his images to what you're gonna be hearing about. His work is great. It's beautiful. He does kind of these really vivid landscapes, and he shoots a lot of transparency film in 4x5, 8x10, 6x17. You know, these are really like exotic formats. And if you follow him on Instagram, what I think is really cool is he's often showing you the original transparency, and then he's showing you his scan, and you can see kind of how close they are. Like, he's really reproducing the beauty of an 8x10 piece of slide film, or 4x5, or 6x17, or whatever it may be. And he's often showing like really what these exotic scanners are capable of doing. And before you ask, like, why don't you scan everything on a drum scan? Well, as he says, it takes him an hour to load, just to load the mounting mechanism to like start scanning. So from a practicality standpoint, it's not going to happen for my everyday operations. But I'm glad that there's services like that out there. And if you know, like I kind of say, like I offer scans that are incredibly usable all the way up to like a gallery show. But if Gerhard Steedel ever calls you on the phone and says, hey man, or you, or I'm sorry to be gendered, but hey you, it's time to make a book and we're going to have it on every shelf in every bookstore. You know, that's when it's like you call up a guy like Michael and you say, okay, it's time to get serious. We're going to do drum scans of every one of these frames. So it's rad that people are keeping this stuff alive, and this, because it's an art, even just what he does. He also has a really good review of Ektachrome, the new E100, because he went to Antarctica to go shoot it, and he's got comes to some interesting conclusions. He shot it with like an F5 and a 70-200 down in Antarctica. Like, that is the coolest way to shoot slide film, in my opinion, to go to some exotic place and make vivid high resolution images on a piece of film. Like, that's absolutely incredible. So I'm going to link to some of these things in the show notes. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy the interview. We recorded it over Skype because I'm still kind of a podcast novice. You know, there's some audio glitches here and there, but I think it's all pretty good. So without further ado, let's get into it. Bye-bye. Didn't hear anything. Okay, let me just make sure.
Stop
recording.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I am a professional. Okay. He is Michael Strickland. Welcome to the podcast. You may know him from his landscape photography that he does. You may know him from his recent appearances on various blogs promoting Ektachrome. He did a review of that, which was rad because I think he's the only person to ever shoot E100 in Antarctica and probably will be for some time. And he runs a drum scanning service, and I'm sure he'll tell me more about what everything he does.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I think I became like aware of your work in like a very nerdy way a long time ago on Instagram, because I was probably like, you know, it was probably like late at night, and I was like, what if I just search hashtag drum scan? What am I going to find?
Probably only me.
That's probably like, it's one of the rare things where you just get like 100 posts, and then I start seeing like, oh my God, this guy's got a Heidelberg Tango. Yeah. And that sounds important.
Yeah, it can be.
But I'd rather go more into kind of like your bio before we get into all of that. So I didn't do a ton of research because I like to kind of find things out as I talk to people. But why don't you tell me about, like, it seems like you have a mechanical engineering background, but you were also doing photography. Why don't you tell me that?
Yeah, I had got my degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Kansas. And then I actually worked for Really Right Stuff, if you're familiar with them. I was a design engineer with them out in California for about 2 years or so. And that's kind of – well, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just said, yeah. I've been kind of aware of Really Right Stuff for a while. I didn't know that you were working there. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was short-lived, but it got me out to California for a little bit and kind of helped build my portfolio. I lived in – San Luis Obispo. So it was right in the middle of Big Sur and was awesome. So I would just jump out at 5 o'clock and go shoot the coast. And on the weekends, I was up and down the coast all the time, and 3.5 hour drive from Yosemite and 5 hour drive from Death Valley. You know, so it was just great location to be working full time. And it kind of just bridged my gap into becoming a professional photographer full time. It's when I was actually working out there that I met Mark Munch, who had an affiliation with the company, and I went down and had a beer with him in Santa Barbara and kind of offered me a job, kind of do a leading workshops part-time. And so I kind of transitioned into that. And that's kind of how it got me going, was teaching workshops every once in a while. So it's been keeping me busy.
At that time, were you still shooting like all digital stuff, or did you discover 8x10?
I started shooting film in college. So I picked up a camera like my, it probably was my freshman year of college, and I was going on a family
vacation. When would that have been?
2010, I think. 2011.
Very cool.
And I was shooting just a little bit. We were going on a family vacation out the Grand Canyon and Monument Valley and whatnot. So I was like, I have a music background as well. I went to Interlochen Arts Academy in Northern Michigan. And so I was always kind of interested in the two-dimensional art. And I actually lived in New York City. I went to the New School. I lived down in the Village for about a year and a half.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And so my roommate actually at that time was a photographer. So I was kind of, he was going to Parsons at the time. And so I had kind of dabbled in the interest of photography when I was 18, 19, but never really had a camera, and phones at that time weren't nearly as good as they are now. So, you know, you could only do so much at that time. And so when I was at KU that I picked up digital, fell in love with the landscape when I went on that vacation. And then I kind of went full force into shooting panoramas for some reason. I was just loved the aspect ratio, probably because I was in Kansas and there's not a whole lot of foreground. Kansas is mostly just flat sky.
Yeah, that's vistas.
And so I was shooting a lot of panoramas, and I was getting really frustrated with how I was having to stitch everything in Photoshop, and because it was prior to Lightroom where you could actually stitch in Lightroom. So I would take anything into Photoshop and stitch it, and if anything was moving or the light was changing rapidly, everything would just be hosed, and then I would waste all of my time. So I started looking into a panoramic camera, and I found, you know, I was dabbling on Google trying to figure out how to make this work, and I had saw someone that had built I was shooting a D810 at the time, and so I was, or no, it was a D800 at the time, and Nikon. And somebody had built a rig that would shoot three photos simultaneously, but that was, you know, that was $15,000 to get something like that going. So I thought, well, I'll try a film camera. So that kind of got me to that. I hated it to start with. I had learned on digital. I was so accustomed to the digital workflow, and I had heard through the grapevine that Fuji Velvia 50 was the hot film to use for landscape photographers. So I started using it and was getting the absolute worst results I could ever possibly imagine. And it was one gorgeous morning that I had photographing this like icy barn on hoarfrost one winter morning. And I had the film developed, and a couple weeks later I had a brilliant, you know, perfectly exposed 617 slide of Velvia 50, and kind of the magic started happening. So about that time, I fully transitioned, sold all my digital gear, bought a 4x5 with it, and the leftover money, I took a trip. That's kind of the history of how I transitioned to film. Yeah. Since I was all in college, so when I was in California, now I was shooting film exclusively.
That's awesome. Did your, Velvia, if people don't know, I mean, people who listen to this podcast may know, but Velvia is this like ultra distinct landscape photographer's film. You try to shoot people with it and they just look bizarre, ultra fine grain. I mean, did your digital work like resemble what you got from Velvia 50 at that time, or was it like a totally different aesthetic?
It was different because I think when I was shooting digital, I was in the crutch of blending exposures. So I would just find a composition that I liked. I didn't care what the light looked like. I would just make it work digitally. And so I think that was the struggle when I transitioned to film. I had to learn really how to see light. And that's when, you know, when I finally got a good exposure, I was facing 90 degrees to the sunrise. And I had this, you know, nicely lit scene that was not, the sun was coming up from kind of to my left, I think, if I can remember right. And so I had actually had exposed good something memory. Right. And I photographed in good light, which I think was the big learning experience that I had shooting film, that was that quality light does actually matter. You can't just fake it digitally.
I think that was the last lesson I learned, even after like graduating college. Like, you have to find beautiful light. If you don't have that, you don't really have anything. It's weird how it just doesn't come naturally, because that's sort of what photography is all about. But that's a hard lesson. I mean, it's good that you kind of picked that up early.
Yeah, totally. It was just kind of, I stumbled on it. And I think we take it for granted these days with digital photography, because you can see about every damn mid-tone you'd ever want to imagine, and some that you don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with film, you have to really concentrate on photographing within the latitude of the film. It's allowance. So I think it's a great learning tool for digital photographers, too, just to be able to shoot with those restrictions, I think.
Yeah, I often think about that, because, you know, they describe slide film as having like 3 to 4 stops, which is probably about right. Maybe Ektachrome has like one more, I'm not sure. Yeah. But and they talk about digital and they're like, oh, you have all this like latitude and stuff. But it's really like when you go to print, you're throwing most of that information away. So like you just have to think differently. The slide is representative of your print. And I mean, although now there's kind of a scanning stage, the scanning stage is really just like a reproduction stage
yeah totally
of original. So it's right. like Like, I generate 8-bit TIFFs for my clients all day long, and we're supposed to think like, oh my God, how could those ever look good? They're just 8-bit. But right. You know, they do. And because it just look like what your print's supposed to look like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of detail that we have anymore that it's really just for the computer screen. I mean, and most digital cameras, you know, in the megapixel battle, I mean, how many people are really printing 60 inches wide these days? And that's why I hate the digital versus film game anyways, is because it's a different medium. I mean, it's completely, oil versus acrylic. It's digital versus, you know, it's Illustrator versus paint. I mean, it's it's a totally different ball game. And, you know, I don't like that argument that one is better than the other. It's just, you know, I like my prints to look a certain way, and I get that with film. And so that's why I've kept it there. And it's, you know, I'm happy with it. So hopefully they just keep making it.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I mean, you're talking to two people that shoot film, and I run a film lab and you run a scanning service. So I guess we're probably biased sources to some extent.
Probably.
But I mean, for me, photography and film just can't be separated. I mean, when I think of making pictures, I think of, you know, getting a roll film, getting my preferred camera, which is a Rolleiflex, putting film in the camera, going out shooting. I just don't think of like getting a phase 1 and then setting it up and doing all this other stuff. For some people, digital photography or photography is setting up a tethered studio shoot and doing a bunch of stuff. It's completely different mediums, completely different approaches.
Yeah.
But I mean,
I think what's about it for me was, you know, I see so many, you know, I teach workshops, and so I see the baby boomers and the 70-plus-year-olds that look at me and my work like, why the hell are you doing that? And I mean, even like Mark Munch, like he cataloged like a million slides for he and his dad that they shot over the course of their lifetimes and his grandfather, like 3 generations of photographers shooting film. And so, you know, they look at film as this just absolute crutch. And so digital came for them as this, you know, golden shining light, and they walked towards it and never went back. And for me, I learned digital, and having the restrictions of film it made sense to me. And so I can see where the argument comes from, like, why the hell would you do that to yourself? But you know, it's art at a certain point. I mean, I love the advantages of digital photography for fashion and for sports and for editorial work and commercial work. I mean, it makes sense. It's awesome. Like I shot sports for a fair amount of time in college, and good Lord, I can't imagine doing that on film. I would hate that.
Yeah. I mean, I ran into that a lot when I was working in commercial fields. Like some of the old timer commercial guys that came up in the 80s and 90s, they're never going to go back to film. But they got into it at a time where you just thought about photography differently. If somebody in the 80s said like, look, you can see your picture immediately and it doesn't cost you in a dime to make another one. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that sounds amazing. Yeah. When you have both, I mean, we have the luxury of thinking about it differently. I think about it like I don't think about it from an image quality perspective at all. I think about it just from workflow and archivality and kind of this like more ethereal things like the real versus the digital. That's kind of where I come at it. But that's a podcast that we could have. That's like a 5-hour series. So it's not.
Sure. That road, probably. It's a rabbit hole. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely. And it always is. Okay, so you've learned this. It was a panoramic camera that you basically had picked up at that time, from what I read, right?
Yeah, it was a Linhof
617. Which one did you get?
It was Linhof 617.
Oh, that's a nice one.
Yeah, too. I got a heck of a deal on it on eBay, so don't get it for yourself.
No, I'm not. I have cameras that are too expensive for words also. So what were you doing with your images at that time? I mean, you didn't, I presume you did not have a Heidelberg Tango like in the back of your truck.
No, I wish. Actually, I was flatbed scanning. You know, I started doing drum scans. I started selling prints when I was still in college, a couple of people, because I was selling just Kansas work. So I've always found that I've never sold a Kansas print to a Kansan, but I've sold a bunch of Kansas prints to people that have moved away from Kansas. It's a nostalgia thing. So it's like, you know, they want to, for their law office in New York City, they want to have a picture of the, you know, a sunflower with a you know, a golden sunset over it. You know, it's a nostalgia thing. So I would occasionally get print sales come through that was kind of supporting my hobby at the time. And mm-hmm. I would then get it drum scanned. And that's kind of the first time I ever got a drum scan. I thought, you know, oh, wow, there's actually a lot more that I had ever thought about film. Cause I was using a flatbed. I still have my Epson V800. And that's what I started scanning film on. And actually a V600 at the time. So it was okay. You know, you got a good base out of it, but you know, if you scanned over 1,000 DPI, you kind of lose basically everything. I mean, you didn't get grain, you didn't get anything. So you kind of had to take it with a grain of salt, so to speak. and so when I first got my first drum scan, kind of just blew me away. And that kind of always got the ball rolling as far as this would be interesting to get into, but it was such a distant, I'd never seen one. I'd never experienced the usage. I just knew that it was difficult and it was an art form within itself. And I was working full time and the behemoth takes, a whole corner of my studio and it weighs 600 pounds and, it's a giant piece of equipment. So in my little 900 square foot place in California, I did not have the space for it. And nor did I even consider it at the time. Kind of just fell on my lap. So more or less.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what percentage of your work do you think you would sort of know that it was time to like go from a flatbed scan to like a drum scan? Because I think that stuff a lot where you have to make your selects.
Yeah, I would basically, I had edition prints, and so I would basically break even on my first print. I would not get a drum scan until I sold the first print, and that would basically pay for the drum scan, the film, all the processing fees, maybe a little bit of my time going out, the print, I'd break even pretty much. I might make 10%. And so I would never get any drum scans until I actually had the sale come through. So it was rare. I mean, I would basically get all the color and whatnot accurate as much as I can to the slide or whatever I was shooting at the time and put it on my website. And if it sold, then I would get the drum scan made, which it was a decent workflow, but it definitely, it changes the image when you get it scanned. I mean, you see a lot more, there's a lot more, color uniformity, and it's a different ballgame when you get in there. So it's nice having it now because I can just make my picks and run the scanner and have it all done in a day. So
how do you think that people would find you generally? I mean, was it through your own network or was it just through your promotional work? Or, I mean, I know that your gallery represented now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you mean my prints?
Yeah, for print sales, like even back then. I mean, now I think you have ways of getting your name out there. But before that, it's hard to sell prints. It's good on you for even getting started that way.
Yeah, I got lucky, I think, is what it boiled down to. I had the KU Alumni Magazine run a feature on me. Well, I didn't have them. They approached me when I was in college about my work. And at that time, I was still shooting digital. And so they kind of followed me out in the field and did a big, six-page interview on my work and what I was doing and engineering student, yada, yada, yada. And that's how I actually got my first few clients was from the Kansas Alumni Magazine. And then when I graduated and I was in California, they ran another one on me. And unfortunately, but fortunately, I think it was the KU volleyball team at the time had just made it to the national championship. And so I didn't get the front page spread, but I still got like an 8-page feature, which was awesome.
pretty good.
Yeah. And so it was, and it goes to, I think it was like 40,000 subscribers it went out to. So that was basically, I just got my list of clients growing pretty substantially. And then from there on out, it's just been kind of word of mouth and whatnot. I've had, Kansas City, there's a gallery that now has a few of my pieces, and it's pokes around here and there at a couple other galleries when I can, and so it helps, but it's definitely not, I can't live on it, but it's part of my business, which is nice.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen you kind of make your prints with like what looks like a 17x22-inch printer, is that right? And then do you have larger sizes in galleries and stuff?
Yeah, definitely, that's my small stuff, and I just started doing pigment prints just this past year. I got that printer basically just to run proofs for myself so I could print. And I was going to do a little bit of platinum palladium printing myself. So I was going to run digital negatives on it and do stuff like that. And then I had been very frustrated with, I'd been printing on Fujiflex with a light jet printer. I have a lab in Boulder that runs some stuff for me. And so usually, I mean, my average print sale size was, for a 4x5 ratio, probably a 32x40-ish. It's kind of the
that's pretty big.
yeah, it's a good size. And so I never had a printer myself, so I just had them do it. Usually it was float mounted with plexiglass and, you know, the whole hot trend right now. And I just kind of got away from it because I didn't like the gloss, and I've had so many complaints about people, you know, not liking the gloss. So then I started doing traditional matting and framing and doing more pigment based prints because, one, they're more archival and I can do it myself and cut the cost down, but they're also beautiful. I love the way the pigment prints look. I've been doing more. I've been looking, investing in a bigger printer so I can do all of it myself. But you know how that goes.
Yeah. I mean, I just bought a Epson P6000 to do partly for the lab and partly my own work. And, I'm still calibrating or not calibrating, but, profiling all the papers, and yeah, it's a big job.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can say that pigment has come a really long way. I mean, I remember for reference, I mean, I entered college in 2003 and graduated in 2007, and people were doing inkjet back then, and I don't know if it was pigment based yet, but I think it was, and they were terrible. I mean, they looked awful. I was doing darkroom, you know, chemical RA4 color enlargements, and there was just no comparison. I mean, like it was night and day. But now, the oldest printer I have is like an R3000 from Epson, which is maybe a generation old, and the prints are better than anything I made in college in the darkroom. Yeah. I mean, as far as color goes.
Right.
So yeah. It's amazing.
The gamut's just continually getting better, and you know, it's wonderful.
The biggest thing for me is the, like, and you touched on it, the archivality, prints are supposed to last hundreds of years. Like the best RA4, which is, if people don't know, RA4 is the color enlargement process. It's like when you get a color negative printed on in the darkroom, the process is called RA4, similar to C41, but just for paper. You know, what do they say, like 70 years?
Yeah, something like that.
I think it's like the long end of it and under perfect conditions. I mean, that's pretty bad.
And then you have to deal with dust, and you have to deal with all of the, you know, the awful things about film, but just in a much larger size, everything's just expanded, you know, to the nth degree. I think that's why we right now are living in the perfect age of film. Like, we're at the height of what film could be and can be for the scanning technologies, the expense of it all of the equipment is coming up in price right now, but it's, you know, better than it was years ago in the, you know, the height of film. And Photoshop and everything is just, we are getting the absolute best film images we could ever get right now. And that's what people don't understand about those that have left film also, is, you know, that they left film at what they considered the height of film, where technology, you know, the Tango is still new. I mean, it's 20 years old. And so that was an $80,000 piece of equipment that was unaffordable for most people. And now it's people like me can have one. I mean, it can be a home use piece of equipment, or more or less. And so it's amazing. I mean, film right now is better than it ever has been.
Yeah. I actually had come to the same conclusion and have over the years. Like, I think that that it was great when you could buy a lot of this equipment new. And I do kind of worry about some of it as it ages, I mean, in terms of the stocks that we have available, they're better than they've ever been. Oh, yeah. And I remember even just 10 years ago, like, I mean, I have a fond place in my heart for Portra, like 160 NC, but the current Portras, like from a technical perspective, like blow it out of the water.
Oh my God.
And I mean, I even see like and you can comment on this because you just did the review, but like, I see a generational difference between Provia and Ektachrome that just came out. I mean, based on what I'm seeing, it's got finer grain. Color's more natural. It doesn't curl.
Yeah.
Fuji.
Yeah. You know, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it in larger formats, because I can't say that I'm an expert in 35 millimeter. I mean, hell, I don't. That was some of the first 35 millimeter that I've really seriously shot. I mean, because it's too small for my work.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. But I feel like that Ektachrome now is in 35 millimeter is probably much more usable for larger prints. And like I had an iceberg image that I shot that I printed up to 36 inches from a 35 millimeter shot, and it's incredible. It looks great. I mean, you can see the grain, but it's the sharpest grain that I think I've ever seen. It's miraculous.
Yeah, it's amazing that you went out to Antarctica, and what did you just take, like an F5 and a brick of Ektachrome? Like,
basically.
Like, oh yeah, that's a good proving grounds. I mean, you know, you could talk about your review. Like, so what did you think? It seems like you were shooting Provia and maybe Velvia and Ektachrome at the same time, and just rolling with it.
Ektachrome and Provia, actually, yeah. And it was kind of an experiment, totally. Like, I had my Mamiya 7 and my Lenhof 617 with me too, so I was shooting those primarily. But I had like a 7200 lens on the F5, so I was able to dabble a little bit more with different focal lengths and whatnot. And so it was just kind of on my hip, not taking it super seriously, but hoping for the best kind of thing. But I was genuinely surprised. It shot well in a variety of conditions and rendered scenes very naturally. I do have to say that I'm a very much of an advocate for letting the film render color how it wants to render the color. So while I appreciate that it is more color neutral in some situations, I do really like how Provia renders snowy scenes. So it would be interesting to, like, Ektachrome would definitely be a stock that I would use for like a raging sunset where I wanted more natural tones, whereas, you know, Velvia will just completely blow it gross in a lot of situations. And so it'll have its uses for sure. I'm excited about it. I'm excited. I'm really excited to shoot it in larger formats.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely boring. I mean, it's definitely going to really shine in 120 and sheets. I am the same way. Like, I have a nice 35 millimeter camera, and I use it some, mostly when I travel. Mm-hmm. I think about formats in terms of like how they will affect the work that I want to do. I mean, I try to channel like a certain aesthetic with the format. So I think about like, well, I'm so glad Ektachrome exists because it just reminds me of the beautiful like National Geographic stuff that we used to see. Cause all that used to be chrome, people with Nikons out shooting stuff. And I mean, it's shocking what you can do as someone that shoots a lot of 120. It's shocking what you can do with 35. I mean, if you look at back at like, if you buy an old Steve McCurry book, like it's all 35 and it's all like really old lenses on, I don't know, he was probably shooting like Fujichrome, Ektachrome, or Kodachrome at that time. I don't know what it all was, but
all of it, probably. Yeah,
probably all of the above, whatever he could get. And his books are, I mean, I've seen some of the pretty large, you know, not like gallery wall size, but you know, like 11x14 ish sizes, and they don't appear to have grains. And these are the stocks from the 80s, and this is today where we have this new film.
Yeah,
and I mean, what did you scan? I saw that penguin picture. I mean, what resolution did you scan that thing at?
Oh gosh, I'd have to look. Huge.
Ziggy size. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was the size of it, actually, like the file size, I think was 750 megs, and God, it had to have been 9 to 11,000 on the long edge, I would imagine. Maybe even bigger.
Yeah, I can't quite remember. It's like, that's insane. I mean, that's like, you know, 30x40 territory.
Yeah, yeah. Easily. I think Photoshop brought it in at 44 inches or something like that on the long edge, which I down-res that quite a bit. Because it was, I don't think.
Now you have to buy an Epson P9000.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Because you can scan it. That's,
exactly.
that's amazing. I mean, I hear what you're saying with Fuji having like kind of a different tonal rendering. I'll be interested to see when Ektachrome gets to 120, because like, I know that it's the same stock, but my Provia images, I always like more in 120, and not just because they're finer grained or sharper. I just find that it's like, it just renders the colors better for whatever reason. Totally. Maybe it's the cameras that I'm using. Yeah. Cause I go from like a Nikon to a Rolly High 6, but it's just like in 35, it's like a little grainier than I want it to be for a chrome. And I see that magenta highlight thing that it does, like especially tone. I don't see that as much in 120. I mean, maybe I just have to shoot more of it, but I think it's just more natural. And
Yeah, I definitely think that film different, like the same film stock will have different effects in different formats. Like, for instance, I love shooting Ektar in 4x5 and 8x10, and I cannot stand it in 120. I don't know what it is, but it just does not work for me in 120. And so I think I definitely know what you mean, because I just don't know if it's just the size and how the grain size is rendering color as a different, you know, magnification and scale, et cetera, et cetera. But it's totally different. Yeah. So you have to experiment with it on your formats that you want to use it on, for sure.
It's weird. Like Ektar, I scan a lot of Ektar for clients. Mm-hmm. I don't shoot it a lot myself, but I really like it every time I scan it, but it's really bad with skin tones. I don't typically like it on people. But I feel like it's because of the nature of slide film, just having kind of the very like kind of luscious tonal scale and colors that it has. Mm-hmm. Even though that Ektachrome is like a neutral stock, it reminds me of Ektar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, sure.
And so it's like being able to have Ektar with like good skin tones.
Yeah, sure. So I can see that.
That's what I'm excited about, because I do shoot people like occasionally.
Yeah.
Often I'm scanning people's Ektar work and I'm like, oh, why am I not just shooting this? This film is cheap and it's awesome. It's so good.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to get into like your scanning business too. So your Heidelberg Tango, it sort of looks like it would be at home in the engineering room on the Enterprise. I've seen it basically in your Instagram, like in your Instagram videos. I was kind of watching your Instagram stories as you were sort of building this like new studio space, which looks awesome, by the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This thing, I'll just describe it and you can stop me when I'm wrong, but like a PMT drum scanner, it's called a drum scanner because it has these tubes that you load the film into and you fluid mount them. So they're like encased in a fluid, and then the negative or positive spins around, and this scanning technology called a photo multiplier tube reads it and creates this ultra high quality file. Like how much of that is right?
No, that's pretty solid. You did a pretty good job. There's not much more I could add to it. Yeah, the drums
are... a photo multiplier tube?
It's basically a tube that collects electrons in a certain spectrum. So it's an analog to digital, a true analog to digital process. So if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, Tango designers, but I believe there's three tubes, an R, a G, and a B, that collect the different spectrums of light, and then they recompile it and ones and zeros essentially back in the computer. So what you're achieving is extremely smooth tonal gradients across, especially transparencies. Negatives not so much, because it's a negative. So you don't really, you gain sharpness on a drum scanner, but you don't gain a whole lot of tonality because it's negative is a weird emulsion. I don't know how it works. With the transparency.
No, I hear you. I understand that.
You get these crazy tonality transitions that are just unparalleled. I mean, it looks exactly like the film. And so whatever you see on a light table, I mean, you can't make magic out of it. If it's a black slide, you're going to have a black image. But you can pull, basically, if you have the best light table or the best bright light shining through your film and you can see detail in it, you're going to see it on the drum scan. So it's remarkable in its dynamic range and its tonality rendering. And it's because of those photomultiplier tubes that are, you know, collecting all of that information and converting it digitally, rather than using like a CCD sensor or something like the Hasselblad flex tights and some of those, the virtual drum scanners, they're using a CCD sensor. So it's still a true digital process. So it's collecting images just like it would on a digital camera, whereas the drum scanner, Heidelberg, and I believe some of the other ones, the older ones and the Aztecs that are still being in production, they are all photomultiplier tubes, if I'm not mistaken.
So Aztec still makes these things? I didn't know that there was anybody still making.
I'm pretty sure. I might be completely wrong, but I know that the Aztec 8000, at least they're still servicing it, so they're probably still, either they have a lot of parts or they're still running a few of them occasionally. And that's what I used to get my film scanned on when I was doing it commercially with my lab, was an Aztec 8000.
And do they still make parts for your scanner? Is it being serviced? No,
it's being serviced. So basically Carl Hudson, the Hudson Graphics, basically he used to work I think he was a sales rep or a service technician or something for Heidelberg in Germany, and would travel around and service these professionally. Yeah. And so he is now collecting all of these units and pulling them out of garbages and, you know, basically just finding, trying to collect all of the remaining PrimeScan and Heidelberg's Tangos around the world. And he has a warehouse in Atlanta, I believe, and one in Germany, and just full of old units. And so he's selling them and refurbishing them and collecting parts off of them. And I get service from them every 2 years or so. And so, you know, I have a foreseeable future with the Tango. I don't know. I mean, it could go tomorrow and then I just have to fork up the chains for a new one. But there are still ones that are still fully serviceable and repairable. And, you know, I see a good at least 20 years down the line of having a Tango, I hope, knock on wood, as much wood as I can knock on. But yeah, I mean, it's running just like new, and I think it has 20,000 hours or something on it. So it's a good unit.
So how many, 20,000 hours. How long does it take you? Let's say you wanted to scan, I don't know, a 1x5. How long does it take you to make a scan?
About 45 minutes. Well, this actual scanning process is 45 minutes. So you're limited to the amount of film you can fit on the drum. So I can fit, I think it's about 16x16-ish. It's a little tight. I can do an 11x14, barely squeezing it on. So I can do an 8x10 and a couple 4x5s. I can do 6 4x5s. I could do somewhere upwards of 60, 35 millimeters or 40 to 60, something like that. You know, so I can get a chunk of film on there, but it goes through and it does a pre-scan. So what it'll do is that the amount of data coming into the computer is based on how fast the drum is rotating. So if you want a super, super low resolution file, it's going to spin faster because it reads the pixels faster and it can, you know, does whatever. And so for the pre-scan, just like you would do on a flatbed, just to get the images so you can make your edits and get all your tonality adjustments and make sure everything looks how you want to look, it runs at 2,000 RPM. So it's just hauling ass. It's spinning as fast as you can go. And that usually will take, hopefully not very long, because it's a scary process. So with like, you know, an 8x2, it probably takes, okay, let's start over. It takes probably an hour to mount the drum, no matter how many pieces of film are on it. And then it takes probably
an hour.
Yeah, it takes a good chunk of time because you're cleaning every individual frame, trying to get all the dust off. You have to mount, the film is between the acrylic drum and a piece of Mylar. And so you have this optically clear Mylar that you buy from Aztec, and you tape it to the drum. You put the fluid between the drum and the Mylar, then the film goes in, you roll it over, and so it's kind of like sandwiched in between the acrylic and the Mylar. And so it takes some time, and then you have to tension it and tape it and make sure that it doesn't come flying off inside the drum scanner. And that's the scariest part. So that probably takes it. If I have a full drum, it's an hour. I just did one right before you called me, and I started at about 9 o'clock my time, and I got done at about 9:45. So, and it was on the scanner and rocking and rolling at 9:45. And then it varies based on each individual size. Like the 8x10 and the 4x5s will take about 45 minutes a piece. A 6x17 takes like an hour and 15 minutes, or hour and a half sometimes, depending on the size that I want out of it. 35 millimeters take about 20 minutes or so. So, I mean, if I have a full drum of 35 millimeters, it will run for like 18 hours.
That's crazy. I mean, so are you running this thing like every single day? I mean, do you have like enough client base to facilitate that?
Yeah. If I'm not running client film, I'm running my own film, which I have a big fat stack of that is backing up over the last couple of years. And because I'm trying to scan some of my older film too. So I'm trying to run it at least 4 times a week is my goal, is to run 4 to 5 drums a week.
Oh, okay. Like, who would have been the intended purchaser of these when they made them new?
A lot of editorial places. Like, I know my good friend out in Greeley that bought one actually right before I did. He, Alex Burke, you may follow his work too. He bought one, and his was from Playboy. So he has a Playboy bunny. the backside of it. So that's kind of funny. So, I mean, back in their heyday, you know, they'd be $60,000 to $80,000 for the tangos, and these places would buy them and basically print money. I mean, there was such a high demand for film replication and, archival replication during the late 90s and early 2000s that they would just crank out, and there'd just be, you know, you'd buy one for $80,000 and be paid for in a month or two. Like, they were doing tons and tons of work on, you know, these scanners. And, I mean, film was an intended purpose. I think, you know, that was part of it, but a lot of it, you know, was a lot of big editorial organizations, like I'm sure Vogue had one, and, you know, all of the commercial clients, you know, had one. And it was definitely labs, of course, you know, photo labs, but definitely not an end user product like they are more so today.
Yeah. I mean, some of that stuff, I think it's great that it has become more accessible. On the other hand, like, I'm sure that it's taken you, there's a learning curve, and I'm sure that it's taken you kind of a fair amount of time just to like wrap your head around the operation of it. So I don't think that it can ever truly be like a consumer product. I mean, not that photography really ever at the level that you're practicing it would ever be.
Yeah, I think I probably ran 100 drums before I really wrapped my head around it and was very, very confident scanning someone else's film. So when I got it, it was November of 20. So I guess it was September of 2015, maybe 2016. I can't remember. But I got it from an old lab that was down in Arizona. And someone called me and said, hey, this lab's, you know, selling their scanning equipment. Do you want it? And so I said, well, sure, I'll give him a call. And so I called him, and he actually had two units. Because I didn't even think about it at the time. I was just still, like, Alex was actually scanning some of my work, and I thought, you know, I just not interested in it. I didn't have the place for it. And then I got a call and said, oh, hey, they're, you know, and it was a good price for him. He said one worked and one was completely dead. So I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a whirl. So I called Brian Adderer, who's Carl's assistant, lives in Brooklyn, actually.
He's got his own scanning shop now.
He does, yeah. And he's the one who services in the United States usually, so he'll come probably later this year and service mine again. But I called him up and I said, you know, I don't know how to transport these things. I know they're, you know, super heavy. They're fragile. Like, what do I do? And so he basically said, well, I'll go fly out there and rent a truck and bring it back if you want. Because I was actually leaving for Canada on a workshop, like, days after this was, you know, supposed to happen. So Brian flies to Arizona, picks up the units, drives to Kansas, drops them off, and I am gone before he leaves. So it was like, I had these brand new scanners. I didn't even get to look at them, and I was on a plane for Canada for 3 weeks. So when I got home, he ended up flying back out. I had the room built while I was gone. You know, I did a lot of the sheetrock work and whatever myself and my family did. Mm-hmm. We got everything all kind of positioned and ready to go. The ceiling was not even completely in when Brian showed up. And started work. He tore down the unit, cleaned it all, got it all running, and then gave me a couple of days of operator training. And then I left, and I was free to screw up my own film. And so I probably ran 100 drums in 2 months. So I was running 2 drums a day solid for 2.5 months. And I got
just extra like your own work.
Yeah, my own work, and I was just trying to, you know, figure out all the ins and outs of making something work and how to scan negatives and how to scan transparencies and different film stocks. And yeah, and so I felt like I got it really fine-tuned before, you know, I started accepting clients. And I do Ben Horn's work now, and he was actually my first client, and he trusted me enough with his 8x10s, lo and behold. And so it kind of just grew from there. He's actually helped me build this quite a bit with a lot of people that follow his work and whatnot. And so it's been good. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, too, because, you know, I get to see not only my own film scan, but clients' work now that is just – that's always fun to see. Like, I've gotten, you know, architectural work. I've gotten black and whites, negatives, you know, art school work. It's just such a broad spectrum of film that I've never would have shot myself. And it's been a joy to be able to see other people's work.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I've really enjoyed kind of accumulating other photographers and use my lab, and I get to see all their work. And
yeah,
I mean, as someone that shoots a lot of large format myself, like, I don't see a ton here. I can scan large format, but I love shooting large format. I love seeing large format. So mm-hmm. it must be great to just kind of see, like, especially like when you get 8x10, like, do people send you a lot of 11x14? I know you can do it.
No, very rarely. I've done a handful of 11x14, but most people are shooting 11x14 and optically enlarging, I feel like, rather than shooting, you know, scanning it.
I honestly find that surprising.
Yeah, I found a lot of 11.
Surprising because the enlargers are crazy.
Well, I guess, okay, maybe not optically enlarging, but contact prints. Like the guy that I know, I've scanned some for, he just wanted basically a digital representation of his 11x14. So when he does contact prints, he has at least an archival representation of the film. So,
yeah,
it's interesting.
Well, I mean, it's always been a dream of mine to like get some Portra, like 160 and 11x14 and just go out and rock it. Just like a lot of people do like wet plate and stuff. I'm like, no, just give me the newest film. I want to shoot it in 11x14.
Exactly. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. Cause you know, with the Tango, the 11x14s were sharp. 8x10s are sharp, but you know, I feel like around that 5x7 range is like the perfect large format film to scan because you're getting that resolution versus film grain like lined up perfectly, because when you start shooting ultra large format like 8x10, 11x14, when you're drum scanning it, the pixels and the grain sizes are kind of fighting each other, so you get this weird almost like artifactual rendering crap going on in the film that you or in the scan that you have to kind of fudge out with apertures and whatnot in the scanner, and so you lose a little bit of resolution to do that. I mean, mind you, 8x10s and 11x14s are just insanely sharp. Like, I think the 11x14 came in at like 90 inches or something like that. It was just gigantic, ginormous, huge thing. But, you know, I feel like I've actually been shooting more 4x5 since I've owned a drum scanner since 8x10 is also a pain in the ass to shoot in most cases, and it's also a pain in the ass to scan. But you're not gaining a whole lot with 8x10 when you're drum scanning because you have that, you know, optical issue going on with the scanners and the sizes.
Yeah, I mean, these days with film being, I don't think that there's a granularity. I mean, yeah, like 8x10 is finer grained for sure.
Yeah,
obviously. But I mean, honestly, at the print size that I usually imagine for myself, which is, I mean, well, now I have a P6000, so 20x20 approximately. Mm-hmm. I can do that with a 6x6 and get like relatively grain free images. So I go up to like 4x5 or 8x10, it's really just gilding the lily.
Yeah.
And a lot of senses. I mean, what was your entry point to 8x10? Because I know you shoot it, or you used to shoot it a lot for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a crazy, like, path to go down, considering, first of all, how much 8x10 chrome costs.
Yeah, it was kind of a bigger is better thing, but initially, to be honest, that I wanted to try.
Yeah.
Because I was shooting 4x5, and I was relatively successful with it, so I thought, you know, Ben Horn was an inspiration. I won't deny that. Like, I loved his work, and I loved his workflow, and I wanted that challenge of a bigger camera, more resolution, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted the prints, you know, I mean, you can get a 48x60 inch 8x10 print that is just magnificent. Whereas in 4x5, you'll see grain, but with 8x10, you know, you're still just going to be 4 times larger. So, you know, you have advantages. But so I think that was probably honestly the road that I wanted to go on was I wanted to just get that extra. I wanted to have the workflow be more, you know, slower. I wanted to be more methodical. I wanted the expense of the film. So I would slow way down, because even with 4x5, I'd go out and shoot a box of film. Like, I was that would have fun with it.
Yeah, it's easy to do.
It's so easy to do. And also now, you know, looking back on it, the tech, because I bought an 8x10 within a year and a half of buying a 4x5. Like, it was a fast transition for me, and so the technique of 8x10 has to be so much more precise and more in tune with what you're doing than with 4x5. And so now when I go back to 4x5, it's like a point and shoot. Like, I'm set up and focused and have everything going within, you know, minutes. Whereas an 8x10, you know, it's a 5 minute plus ordeal. And with, you know, 4x5, I already have 3 shots done. And So, I mean, it's a totally different workflow. And it's kind of like you mentioned earlier about, like, shooting with particular formats in mind. Like, you know, with 8x10, I go out and I expect to shoot, you know, 5 sheets maybe in a day. Maybe. You know, I'm lucky if I came
home. That's a big day.
Yeah, I'm lucky if I come home with a box of film of 8x10 exposed. Like, I really am concentrating on that. With 4x5, you know, I run and gun. I take more risks. I, you know, will shoot different scenes because you have a different depth of field. You know, it's, and then with like my Mamiya 7, like, it's weightless on my back compared to both of those cameras. And so when I'm, you know, backpacking or doing my thing there, like, it's not a view camera, so it's a rangefinder, so you're set up in seconds. You are taking the photo almost before you have the camera on the tripod. It's that fast. And so it's a totally different method of finding compositions and in exposing a photograph, because you can act more instinctually and more emotionally. Whereas an 8x10, it's definitely much more methodical, which I mean, there's definitely room for both. I enjoy shooting all formats. I've not ever turned down a format.
It's never been a format I didn't like. That's right.
No, exactly.
I can chase that all the way down. I've chased that from Super 8 to 8x10, and I had fun with every single one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw 8x10 work, I think I was in college, and it was probably my second year of college, and Alex Soth, who came out with his book Sleeping by the Mississippi, and I sort of became aware of 8x10, and then I went and saw some of his prints at the Minneapolis Art Institute, and they were huge. I mean, they were like, you know, multiple feet long, and there were these portraits, and you could just like swim in them, and I was like you just wanted to swim in the tones and the detail and everything, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm getting a Deerdorf now.
Oh, yeah.
And I did. And I made a bunch of really bad, very expensive pictures. and I kept, like, I owned a few 8x10 cameras over the years because, like, I had one in college, and then I sort of got rid of it as I started doing other things. And then I got one in New York City, and then I realized that having an 8x10 in New York City is horrible because you can't move it anywhere and you don't have a car. And so I got rid of that, and now I've kind of, now I have my largest format camera is just a speed graphic, but it's simple, and it makes a big negative, and it's nice.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of large format too, is it is so simple that you can photograph with a potato. I mean, it's literally all you need is, you know, a box with a lens in the front of it, and you can shoot large format, which there's definitely beauty in.
So thankfully, Kodak and Fuji have not yet totally killed us with prices on 4x5. Like, you can still pick up a box of Portra 160 for $35, it seems like.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I mean, I shot my last project on all Fuji Provia in 4x5, and they do 20-sheet boxes, which is even nicer, and it's not that bad. Nice. I mean, you know, it's so easy to scan because it's like right in front of you and the detail is all there, and you're working a lot when shooting chrome anyway. It's not like I necessarily need the flexibility of the negative. So, I mean, like that, I encourage people to pick up like chrome film, especially as they get into larger formats, because the difference in quality, I think, is pretty apparent.
I mean, well, the difference in
color negative films.
Yeah. I think, you know,
and
for
the
me,
detail there is...
yeah, I mean, when I'm going out to shoot anything, I think what I'm looking for is a color palette. And I think, I mean, I've actually been shooting a fair amount more negative film recently because I've wanted a particular form or color palette with this project that I've been working on. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that there is ever going to be one film stock that I can use, because, I mean, I took a trip out to Zion and shot nothing but reflected light and mud, basically, and ice for 4 or 5 days, and shot like 40 sheets of film, and it was all chromes. And I actually did try some negatives, but my Jobo's been kind of on the fritz, and so I've just now gotten it up and running. So I'll be able to develop my own film here hopefully soon. I've been trying to experiment with it, because the way transparency film renders reflected light is unreal. I mean, it's what your eye is seeing if you're really trained to see it. And with negative film, it has such a low contrast that I don't know if it's going to be able to be, you know, replicate the, you know, Velvia and Provia. I don't know. I'd love to see it, because I have a feeling that we'll see film from Kodak a lot longer than we'll see film from Fuji. hopefully not. Hopefully Fuji continues to produce some film. But, and I think, you know, it'll just change the work. I'm not too afraid of losing my film stocks. I used to be, and anymore I just think, you know, you'll just adapt and move on. But I don't know that it will be, I don't know if you'll be able to recreate some of the tonality and the subtle color differences that Fuji, that Velvia 50 in particular can, you know, pick up. So it's just interesting.
I mean, it's weird. Most of my favorite photographers are like shoot mostly color negative film, and I really love the aesthetic they come up with. I don't know why. I myself have graduated towards chromes, or gravitated, I should say, towards chromes. I mean, I just love that experience where you're looking at them on the light table, and you kind of you see is very much what you get with them, and you're just like, oh, this is it.
There are no surprises.
I mean, back in college, I was reversing FP4. To make black and white transparencies.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And I don't know. I just love it. I mean, it's just like this, like these delicate originals.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of like that concept where you have this original thing. Where, I mean, it's sort of, like in photography, it was in an early time, it was criticized because it was thought of as being no original. But I mean, there sort of is. It's the negative or it's the positive, whatever you shot. Mm-hmm. In digital, it's like, that concept is like completely gone.
It is, yeah.
You know, there's no, it's like whatever copy. It's always a copy of a copy of a copy of a file that isn't really real anyway. So it's like,
exactly.
I kind of like to distill that down into this thing that you can hold in your hand and kind of like you don't need like a third party piece of software or enlarger or something to view. You just can look at it and go, oh, okay, that's a picture.
Right.
The last thing I wanted to ask about is kind of just like your work. I mean, what projects are you working on now? I think you briefly touched on that. Like, how do you approach creating new portfolios? Like, I would love to know kind of
that's a tough one. I travel a lot. I'll be going to, I have an unbeknownst number of flights that I have to be on next year. This year is a little lax, so it's nice. But so when I'm on the road, I'm kind of looking for a general aesthetic. I love the deserts, so I like, you know, I've always gravitated towards the desert Southwest and the desert landscape. I've been enjoying the poles. I'm heading to Svalbard and three trips to Antarctica again in the next 2 years. But it's a kind of a different workflow when I'm teaching because I can't, you know, completely devote my time and my focus. So I kind of have to be a little bit more run and gun with that. But it'll still be enough to build this, you know, a solid body of work over the next few years. But I'm kind of gravitating towards more, I guess, book projects. I have probably 5 or 6 different ideas in my head of smaller scale, you know, bodies of work rather than big prints, because I feel like, one, it's hard to sell big prints to people because they don't have the wall space, and photography is kind of a weird medium right now to be selling large work. And I think people are more likely to collect books, and you can build a project more on an entire body rather than one-off prints, which has kind of been my workflow of the past few years. And I'm also kind of looking for I don't know what the right word is for it. I'm shooting closer to home. So I'm kind of working on a project revolving around grain right now. I mean, I live in Western Kansas and I live right in the grain belt. And so I want to start working on some portraits of farmers and doing some more work.
Oh, that kind of grain. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's there's kind of a play on words.
My wife, the other grain.
Yeah. Kind of eat. So, I mean, just different projects that kind of keep my mind open to different, because through and through, I'm a landscape photographer. That's what I've always been. And so I'm kind of trying to push my own boundaries a little bit and look more at the urban landscape and more of the portraiture work and storytelling, because I do love that work, and it'll just challenge me a little bit more photographically. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was just gonna say, so I mean, it seems like you've just kind of really enjoyed like the exploratory process of finding new landscapes and new spaces.
I think when I go out to shoot,
at the end of the world.
Yeah, exactly. When I go out to shoot, I kind of just shoot whatever I feel like shooting, and then hopefully a body of work builds, you know, after that, you know, after I've shot a little bit. So I don't ever turn down a shot because it doesn't fit into a certain aesthetic or theme that I've been working with. Like the poles, I never thought that I would, you know, shoot and have, you know, a collection of 60 Antarctic images. And I just, you know, I went down there expecting I'd have a lot of penguin shots, and I've come home with some of my favorite images that I've ever photographed. And so that's, you know, the same thing with the bottom of the Grand Canyon. I've always had this love of the Grand Canyon and the desert Southwest in the United States. And that's kind of developing into a project focused around the watershed of the Colorado. So all of the rivers and the tributaries and whatnot that form the Colorado River. And so I've been working on that for a while. And I mean, some of them may never culminate to being anything, but it's just, when I go out and shoot, I just shoot. I might have an idea in my head and go out for a particular reason, but if there's a truck sitting on the side of the road that has really cool boxes on it that like make a cool texture, I'm not going to turn down an 8x10 shot of that because it's just cool looking. So
I hear that.
Yeah.
I like to set rules for myself. I like to say like, okay, I'm going to only shoot this camera or this format, and going to be in this place because I have very bad ADD. So I love one of the things that really originally attracted me to photography is that there's so many things to try and explore and experiment with in terms of cameras and formats and another thing. And I have to stop that instinct if I'm going to create a coherent portfolio.
Totally.
You know, like, you have to I'm going to shoot mostly 6x6, sometimes 4x5. That's it. It's probably going to be color.
Yeah.
And that's just like, do you do that?
Totally.
I mean,
I think
I was just going to say, like, you have a lot of different formats to choose from.
Yeah. And I'm a gear freak, just like 99% of photographers. I love gear. It's fun. Plus I'm an engineer. And so I like the way things tick. When I go out, I think I never carry more than one camera in a pack. And if I go out on a shooting trip, I'll either shoot large format or medium format. Like, I don't carry both. I feel like 8x10 and 4x5 are kind of one and the same in my mind to some extent. 4x5 is just a faster version of 8x10 that's easier. So I'll carry both. And then if I'm going on like a day hike, like more of an exploratory hike, I'll generally throw the 4x5 on my back and, you know, just go find something, and then if I shoot, then yeehaw. But and then maybe go back with the 8x10 or something like that. But I will never carry like a 8x10 and a 6x6 or an 8x10 and a 6x17. And I've done it before in the past, and I've just spun myself in circles trying to figure out compositions, and that's just too much for my brain to handle. So I really like to think in an aspect ratio. Like, I went to New Zealand last year with only a 6x6, and so I shot only 6x6 in New Zealand, which was fun. And it's just a completely different compositional mindset. But if I was shooting 4x5 and 6x6, I would be thinking too much in both realms, and I just can't function that way. Absolutely.
Yeah. When I travel, I mean, I try to just bring like a TLR. So there's even fewer choices. Like, you just get the one lens.
Right.
And you're just not even able to, because I've had the same issue. I've gone on trips or whatever, or shooting trips where I've brought like, you know, five different cameras, and I'm like, oh, this will be great. I have so many choices, but then then you just run into choice paralysis and you don't end up doing anything.
Well, it's the same thing with lenses too. Like, when I'm shooting 4x5, I carry four lenses, which is probably too much in, you know, a lot of ways. But I'll go out with a mindset like, I'm only going to shoot with a 500, you know, shoot really telephoto or something like that. Or I might have one of my bigger lenses in the car or something where, you know, if I see something on the side of the road, I'll get out and shoot it. But if I'm with 8x10, I even have fewer lenses in it. I think I carry three normally. Because if you get too many lenses, first of all, your packet's too damn heavy. And another is just you're compositionally way too scattered. Like, if you only have a wide angle lens, you know you can't shoot something on the ground. Unless you really, you're really creative, which is part of it. Like, I mean, it forces creativity and forces your mind to work in a particular aspect ratio or field of view, which is, I think it's advantageous.
Yeah, and the challenge is fun because you're chasing light. You know, you don't really know what you're going to run into. It's like just enjoyable being under the dark cloth, unless you're in New York City, in which case it's terrifying.
Yeah, or on a train track, which is doing the other day. Next to, sorry, I was
just
not
just take
on
the earbuds right. out.
Yeah.
Just take off your headphones and be aware of your surroundings. Yeah, it can be dangerous.
A little bit.
I mean, so I like that you said that you were kind of seeing your work in books more, because I think like books and photography are really like the right combination. I mean, yeah, like prints are beautiful and I enjoy making them. And I think that they're like the ultimate representation of my work in some ways. Yeah. But like I've said sort of before, it's almost impossible to sell a print. I mean, it's rare to do. And whereas a book, like photography is rarely, like it's not a painting. Like it's rarely like you're making one. I mean, you kind of are in your landscape work. I mean, maybe not in your series work, but like where you're making one image and you go like, this is the picture. Here you go.
Right.
Like, this is what I made. Like for me, it's always a string of pictures. It's always like, I don't know if I'm telling stories with my work, but I'm like exploring something. You might call it like variations on a theme. Totally. So having pages makes sense. And also like people don't have to like commit to having that on their wall to the same extent.
And most of us don't have the luxury of having, you know, a gallery that we could do that with large scale prints. I mean, that's what a book is to a gallery show or representation of a series of a body of work. I mean, and that's kind of where I'm going, is hopefully that I'll produce bodies of work that will be representable, because at this current time, you know, I have one-offs. I have, oh, here's a pretty picture. Oh, here's a pretty picture. And I mean, the more I'm growing in my own work and in the direction that I'm trying to head personally with my work, I think it will develop over time in the larger bodies of work. But I mean, I've only been shooting for 5 years or so now, and it's just, there's not a lot of film that's been exposed. So, I mean, it's, as I expose, a, you know, 10,000 sheets of film, I'm sure that I'll have a be able to fill the gallery with a certain, you know, aesthetic or body of work. But I am with you. I mean, I think photography is easier in a lot of ways to produce a body or a cohesive collection of work that is unique to art in a lot of ways. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest advantages of photography, because we can go out with one roll of film and create a body of work. Whereas, you know, with painters or, you know, most of two-dimensional artists, you would have to spend a year, you know, producing that.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like what, I mean, you, I've never spoken to him. It seems like, you know, Ben Horn better than I do. And I like what he does, where he just creates his yearly portfolios that he sells. And they're like a certain number of prints and they're all in this book. Like that's a great way to kind of get work out there. And they're all like not that big, you know?
Yeah. I think he does 8x10 prints, like contact prints, so to speak.
Yeah. That's like, that's a really good balance. I mean, you can kind of like have them on your shelf. You can have them on your wall. You can kind of, they're the highest quality, like probably reproduction of what he does. That's a really cool way to approach it. I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff that people do, especially now with like zines and little editions and stuff like that. Right. It's really neat. And I mean, having the technology that we have available to us, like your drum scanner, makes it easier now.
It does.
Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but thank you for doing this. Do you have anything you want to promote? Any kind of, I know you teach workshops and do other things like that.
Yeah, I teach all my workshops for Muge Workshops. We travel now all in 7 continents. I teach about 50 days a year, something like that, about, you know, 7-8 trips a year. My drum scanning business is available when I'm not traveling, so usually there's about a 2-week turnaround if I'm home. Even if I'm not, usually about 2 weeks from when the film is delivered. So I'm, you know, I'm available for portfolio reviews and drum scanning and whatever anybody really needs as far as photography is concerned. I'm kind of open. So
I will put your website and drum scanning stuff in the show notes. What is your Instagram handle so people can kind of look up you right now?
It's M Strickland Images.
M Strickland. It's a good follow, everybody, because you can kind of, you just like, you see a lot of zooming in on pictures and you're just like, it goes that far.
Exactly. Yeah.
that's rad. Well, thank you for doing this, man. And, good luck with your scanning business and your artwork.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.